We'll be starting on lesson 12 actually today. Lesson 12 and lesson 13 are on the back. That'll be the last lesson. So we're not going to go through chapters 9, 10, and 11 in any detail, but we're going to just kind of review over those for just a moment. You know, as we have kind of finished up the last lesson, we've seen the agreement, the covenant that the people have made with God, that they were going to obey His will, going to obey His laws, and Jerusalem now is once again becoming a city that is going to be filled with the people of God. And so there are the Jewish leaders that we've identified and we've seen that have come into the city. You have the priests and the Levites and the gatekeepers and the singers and all of these different ones that play a part in the worship of God, you know, who have been identified and come together. And they, along with their families, are there in Jerusalem. You know, they and the people have again have become separated from the neighboring peoples. And they've done this for the sake of God, because they have seen and realized that they cannot live with and be married to those who are in the world, these pagan nations and stuff. They've seen now where that has taken them. And so they've made these changes. And so Jerusalem is looking different. And I don't mean that just the temple had been rebuilt and now the walls have been rebuilt. I'm sure that looks different too. But that's not the point. The people are beginning to look like the people of God. You know, and that they have changed their life and they have begun their worship before God once again. And so now things are becoming organized in the way that it was given to Moses long ago, you know, with regard to the priests, you know, leading the people in the reading of the word and worshiping God the way He's supposed to be worshiped. Even they've reinstituted what some have called the temple tax, you know, the pledge that was made to, you know, care for the temple, a certain amount that was given for that. In chapter 9, in fact, it said, we will not neglect the house of God. And so there's that commitment that's been made too. You know, they've made a lot of commitments here in these chapters, chapter 8, 9, 10. I mean, there's been a lot of promises that have been made. But it seems, at this point, the promises are being followed up by action. You know, that they are, in fact, trying to do the will of God. Then there are some other new residents in Jerusalem. There were a lot of people living outside of the walls of Jerusalem. And it's still going to be that way. Because as some would estimate, that throughout the tribe of Benjamin and Judah, there would perhaps be as many as a million Jews. Well, you can't put that many into Jerusalem, into the city. And nor should there be. Because there has to be those who are still living out in the ancestral grounds, I guess you would call, where they've lived for generations, and those who till the fields and make produce and do other things for a living. Everyone can't live in the city. But there seems to be this interest in this effort of putting within the city, you know, Jews who were living as God would want and, you know, continuing this worship as it should be. And so to fill the city with rightful inhabitants, that is, you know, Jews that were not mixed with other nations, the leaders cast lots, you know, to bring one out of every 10 Jew living out in this outside area, you know, into the city. And so that's how they're going about this process of, you know, inhabiting the city once again. Chapter 11, chapter 12 tells us more about that. And so as this is all getting done, this is all being processed now, and the walls are done, the gates are hung, you know, these systems are put in place, there comes a day of great celebration. And it may be a little bit hard just to get a full picture of this in our mind, all that happens with this, but it would be indeed a time of tremendous celebration. I mean, it's not just the completion of the wall, but it's the fact that there's this reinstatement of worshiping God as He wants them to worship. And so you try to picture all of this in your mind. Nehemiah and the leaders, they go up on the walls and they march around the walls. Now, I take that to mean probably on the inside of the wall, there's there's a gateway there that you would walk and you can look over the wall, is what I'm thinking, you know, where the soldiers would be and look out over. And so they go up and they walk around these walls. And then there's there's like two choirs of worshipers that as well go up on the wall, one to the left, one to the right, and they go around the wall, and somehow they come back around, they come back to the temple area. And this is where the celebration is going to continue and conclude there as well. And so in the temple area with Nehemiah are the priests, and the priests offered great sacrifices to God, and the rejoicing, you know what the text says in chapter 12, the women and the children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing could be heard far away. I mean, can you imagine what that sounded like? I mean, within the temple area there and within the walls, it must have been incredible to hear all the singing that was going on. But outside of the city, people hear that too, a long way. And so that's kind of interesting to think about and try to get that in your mind. I mean, the people were happy. There was a time of rejoicing for what had been accomplished, for a renewed relationship with God. That would indeed be the reason, truly, for celebration, this renewed relationship with God. And so, you know, the administration of the temple was all kind of set back in place as it was required by the law. There were things that God had dictated through Moses long ago, certain things that were to be done. There were men placed in charge of the storerooms of the temple. Remember, around the temple, there were certain rooms that were built for storage. You know, the contributions, the first fruits that would be given, tithes that were given. So men were put in charge of those things. And it was from those storerooms that the portions that were required by the law for whether it's taking care of the temple or taking care of the priests, you know, to support them, or the singers or the gatekeepers, all of those who are working in the service of God, you know, that was required, you know, within this worship to him. Well, that was taken care of out of those storerooms there, the daily needs for those. And so all of these things were once again being met as God had decreed long ago. And so we kind of leave Jerusalem for a little while. Nehemiah does. I mean, Nehemiah goes back to King Artaxerxes because that's what he had promised to do, remember? I mean, that was the agreement, you know, that if the king would let him go and back to Jerusalem, to the city of his fathers, and help to restore the walls of the city. His promise was that he would come back and serve the king. And Nehemiah is going to keep his word. We wouldn't expect anything other, would we? You know, and so he's going back to serve the king. But he leaves Jerusalem, as far as he can see, you know, in good hands, in good shape, you know, with administrators and leaders and officers that are of the right mind and ability to continue to move forward. And worship to God is going on as it should. We get to the final chapter of Nehemiah, chapter 13. And I presume you've already read through that. Nehemiah returns to Jerusalem and finds he has to make reforms because things are not just the way he left them 2 years earlier. Now, he had been in Jerusalem for about 12 years, is what most say. About 12 years is what it took for the rebuilding of the walls was 52 days, remember? But all the other that was involved in reestablishing the worship as God would want and putting everything in order, he spent about 12 years there. But now he's been back to the king in Babylon for 2 years, and he comes back. And what he finds when he comes back is not at all what he had left. Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 1. On that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people. And there was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted to the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call a curse down on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. And when the people heard the law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. it's kind of a recap that Nehemiah is reminding us of long ago, actually back to the book of Deuteronomy. You know, a period of time when the Ammonites and Moabites were not helpful to the people of God at all. In fact, it seems did everything they could to try to inhibit their progress in doing the things that they wanted to do. And so, you know, Nehemiah is kind of calling this out as a point of reminder, you know, that there are some nations that have not been kind, not been good, and should not be in fellowship with the people of God. Verse 4. Before this, that is, before leaving, I think is the idea, Eliashib, the priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of God. He was closely associated with Tobiah, and he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine and oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, as well as the contributions from the priests, verse 6, for the priests. But while all of this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing that Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and incense. Okay, now can you imagine coming back into this? I mean, he comes back and he sees the changes that have taken place in just these 2 years. You know, Israel suffered without Nehemiah's leadership there. There's probably several points as we go through that we need to think about and talk about with regard to a void of leadership and what happens. And we should emphasize a void of godly leadership. There was leadership, all right, when he was gone. But not good leadership, not godly leadership. And so imagine the disappointment when he came back to learn that they had digressed from their promises to God. Remember when we left off these last chapters, they had just made promises. They made a covenant with God. They all agreed. When they had realized their sin after the reading of the law, they were contrite, they put on sackcloth, they mourned, they fasted, they confessed their sins, and they promised that they would obey God always. And Nehemiah even required they put it in writing and they sealed it. And in just 2 years, they had digressed far from the promises that they had made. Now, when Nehemiah came back, there seems to be four main issues that stand out here in this text as we look forward. You know, first here, during his years in Jerusalem, the Jews were reminded of who they were, reminded of their place before Jehovah God. They committed themselves to faithful worship. And before leaving, before Nehemiah left, Eliashib the priest was put in charge of the storerooms there in the house of God. But Eliashib had made a decision that would lead to some real problems. What was the problem? What did Eliashib do?
He let the enemy in.
That's the best way to put it, Frank. He let the enemy in. I mean, not only was, I mean, Tobiah was the enemy. I mean, all the way through the story with Nehemiah, Tobiah has been there and has been the enemy of Nehemiah and has been the enemy of God. And so, you know, he has been let in, not just into the city gates, into Jerusalem. He's sleeping in the temple. You know, he's been given a place to live in the temple. And then there's a part of me that's just going like, this can't even be real. I mean, let me read that again, but every time I read it, it's the same thing. Sure enough, I mean, he's living in the temple. All right, what else could we say? What are some points that have just got to be considered with this?
Tobiah was an Ammonite. That's the whole reason we're told this.
Exactly right. That's right. You know, at first, when you read the first three verses there, and there's this reference that goes all the way back to Deuteronomy, we wonder, like, well, why is he telling us that? Well, here, this is why he's telling us that. You know, this has been long understood that the Ammonites, the Moabites, have been the enemies of the people of God. And then that they had to look warily at them, to say the least. And here they've let the enemy in, is what they've done. All right? What else would you say? I mean, why do you think Eliashib was made priest? I mean, look, we've already seen that when Nehemiah put others in charge, gave them responsibilities, that there was some emphasis, it seems, that he looked for spiritual men to be in leadership positions. Why did he choose Eliashib? What do you think?
Eliashib was a priest.
Yeah.
And you were a priest as a birthright.
Mm-hmm. You know what I can't help but wonder? I mean, because we have seen the pain that Nehemiah has gone through to try to put into place people of good reputation. I can only imagine that Eliashib was a man of good reputation. I mean, what would make us think otherwise? I mean, Nehemiah has been very careful about that. But what happened?
Why did the other leaders close their eyes?
Boy, here's another issue. I mean, here's another issue you have to wonder. I mean, it's not just Eliashib. I mean, perhaps he was the one in charge of the storerooms. That was his responsibility. But could no one else see what was happening? Surely they could see. Surely others could have identified, wait a minute, that's Tobiah you're letting in. Why didn't some others say something? Maybe they did. Maybe there were some who did. It doesn't record that for us. We don't know. But there seems to me that this illustrates for us some real important points and principles. I mean, I want to presume that Eliashib was a man that had, you know, some reputation for good. That's why Nehemiah chose him for that position. You know, I want to believe that because we've seen that as the character of Nehemiah before, that he tried to choose those who were godly men to put in leadership positions. But sometimes people change.
Tobiah was the enemy all along.
Mm-hmm.
And this just reminds me of how Satan works. Satan will try to defeat you outright. If he can't defeat you head on, then he will try to infiltrate. And it also reminds me of the history of the early church.
Mm-hmm.
Romans persecuted Christians for 200-something years, and the more they persecuted Christians, the more Christianity flourished.
Yeah.
Constantine came along, and he said, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
And so he devised a plan wherein the Roman government could infiltrate the church, and that's exactly what they did, and that became the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. No, it almost seems like for a while here, for the last two or three chapters, I don't think there's anything said about Tobiah in the last two or three chapters up to this point. He didn't go away, but he may have stood back and stood down because he wasn't making any progress with Nehemiah. But when Nehemiah was gone, then he found a way back in. Now, surely there's some lessons we need to learn from that too. Oh, yeah, this leads to more issues, you know, with regard. That's right. That's right. Neil?
You could almost, well, you can see this as an analog to any one of our lives. For 12 years, they've been working hard. We got to the point where, okay.
We've got it done.
We've reached our goals. Everything's working.
Yeah.
We can sit back and relax.
Yeah.
No, we can't.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, you can make some applications sometimes even in your personal life, just with secular type things. You work real hard on something, you get it done. Oh, I'm going to take ease here for a while. And then pretty soon you're at a point where you accomplish nothing, or nothing's going forward anymore. You've seen that in our own lives. We can see that in the church sometimes too. Churches do well, they work hard, they spread the word, they grow. And in a period of time, some of those churches that were such growing churches and doing so well in time are churches that are falling apart and falling away. What happens? You know, there's got to be some points we can think of with that.
It goes along with the old saying, evil companions corrupt good morals. And
exactly.
If you're around enough junk long enough, the junk rubs off.
It's going to stick. There's going to be some of that sticks. Absolutely, it does. And I can't help but wonder. You know, I mean, once Nehemiah was gone, I mean, Tobiah, he was still outside the gate. Well, for a while. Obviously, after a while, he was inside the gate. How did that happen? I don't know. I can't imagine it happened overnight. You know, those things seem to go kind of slow sometimes. Yeah. That's right. That's true. I think that's a good point too. Look at a couple of passages here. Go to Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 13. I just want to think about influence for a second. You know, and Dave has kind of, you know, brought to mind just this point about evil influences. We can argue all we want to that we will not be influenced by those who are worldly. Now listen, God says we better be careful about those things. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 20. He who walks with the wise will grow wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm. Argue against it all you want. Here's what God says about it. Never benefits us to argue against God. We're always wrong. We will just always be wrong. Here's what God says. Proverbs chapter 4, turn back a few pages. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 14. Verse 13, go back to verse 13. Hold on to instruction and do not let it go. Guard it well, for it is your life. Do not set foot on the path of the wicked or walk in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn from it and go on your way. For they cannot sleep till they do evil. They are robbed of slumber till they make someone fall. The picture given of evil men, how hard and how dedicated they will be to making godly people fall. Why can't we see that with Tobiah? I mean, he's just been relentless. I mean, all the way through this story. I mean, for the 14 years of the story that we've read through, Tobiah has been relentless. There for a while, we didn't hear about him anymore. He got quiet, but he didn't go away. He was just hiding over yonder. He was waiting. And when Nehemiah was gone, when strong spiritual leadership was gone, Nehemiah started working his way back in, and he got in. You know, that's just, isn't that amazing? You know, how that happens, you know, that way. You know, Tobiah was able to influence Eliashib, not just to let him in the gates of the city, but I mean, he has a room in the temple. I mean, this just absolutely blows me away. I mean, he's staying in the temple. And I wonder what Nehemiah thought. I mean, we know what he thought about Tobiah being in the temple. I wonder what he thought about Eliashib. I mean, he had to have just felt like he was let down. I mean, disappointed. And as I was reading that over, I just kept thinking, you know, sometimes men will let us down. I mean, men will let us down. God never will. Men will let us down. And so, all the more reason to place our allegiance with the one who will not let us down.
Reminds me of Acts
even among the spiritual leaders of the church at Ephesus, Paul is giving the warning, even some of you are going to stray from the faith. You know, disappointing. We're going to go less than Denny.
Well, I was just thinking that so much of, as you read through the Bible, God makes a distinction between what is dedicated as holy and what is unclean.
So consistent. And, that's right.
Extremely consistent.
Yeah.
And this is an example of, okay, the temple, what was it dedicated for? Mm-hmm. It was dedicated for the worship of God and the praise of God. And then we could, you know, it wouldn't be, if we were to bring that forward, that idea, it wouldn't be right for you or anyone else to start living here in this building. Mm-hmm. This is a building that was built by the treasury of the Lord, by our free will offerings to the Lord. And so, you know, someone moving into one of the rooms and taking, you know, using the facility that was dedicated to the Lord for some other purpose would not be right. And so the division between, and that's what Tobias was doing. He was living in the church building that was dedicated to the Lord.
I would make the analogy a little bit more this way with that. You know, that the temple in the Old Testament was something that represented the presence of God. Now, as the temple was rebuilt here, we don't find the presence of God as it enters it as when Solomon built the temple and the presence of God came upon, much like his presence was in the tabernacle. You know, I mean, that was a holy place. And I don't know that I view this building as the holy place as the temple was of the Old Testament. But in fact, we are to be holy, you know, because we represent the temple of God. And I think that, in my mind at least, as I'm thinking about this and looking at it, you know, part of what was just the extreme rub with this is that temple represented the presence of God in a holy place, and here there was one who was unholy who was living in it. I do look at that a little bit differently, I guess, is what I do, you know, our brick and mortar today. You know, I know among some today, there are among the denominations, you know, they would look at their church building as being a sanctuary, you know, before God. And when you enter into the sanctuary, you are in the presence of God, as if the building itself is something holy. I don't know that I see brick and mortar that way.
But you may have misunderstood me. My point was that we wouldn't, and churches do this all the time now. They have parties, you know, Christmas parties, etc.
I see that point. I do.
Mm-hmm. The sheetrock are holy.
Yeah, I know that. I know that.
But they are paid for mm-hmm. by the treasury of the Lord, which makes them separated unto a specific mm-hmm. purpose. Mm-hmm. And that purpose is holy purposes. They're separated from the world. And so we wouldn't take the, you know, I don't know, the dishes of the Lord's Supper home and eat common meals with mm-hmm. them, not because they're holy, but they're dedicated. That's
what that was like. Well, it's like I have known of situations where preachers, in fact, there's been a room or two built on a building. I mean, you see this in Africa with some regularity sometimes. You know, and a preacher may live there. You know, or there may be a I think I almost say gatekeeper, that's not the word. Sometimes they'll have somebody that lives in the building just to secure the building. If not, people will come in and tear it up, you know, in places such as that. I wouldn't have an objection, you know, to something, you know, such as that. Because the building just represents the brick and mortar. you know. Now, there would be some things that when a church would spend collected funds for the Lord's work, you know, to go out and to build recreation facilities and things like that, you know, I'd have some real objection, you know, to that, you know, kind of a thing. But I guess I'm thinking the thought that we're not so far apart on this, really. I mean, we have the same idea that we are what must be holy. The church is what, you know, we are the church. And we are what must stand as holy before God. You know, I do see some distinction, though, with the temple of the Old Testament. I think God viewed that as being holy. That's why he had certain rules and laws with who could enter in at certain times.
Because we serve God.
Yeah.
We have Tobiah in there that shouldn't be in there at all. You know, and you know, we look at the things in our lives and the things we're allowing to enter into our lives and our minds and our hearts. Those are the things we need to primarily be concerned with.
Which before we know it can be living in us, you know, taking up the storeroom, so to speak.
But that wasn't the comment I was gonna make earlier. we're talking about leadership and Nehemiah being God, and you know, there's the expression, I don't know exactly how it's said, but it's that evil flourishes when good men do nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, and there could have been a bunch of the men saying, Tobiah really shouldn't be here. This, mm-hmm. You know, but nobody was doing anything about it because Nehemiah wasn't there. And you know, we can all be leaders by speaking out when something's wrong. It doesn't matter who you are.
That's right. Stand for what's right. You see, to me, it's not just Eliashib. I mean, was he the one ultimately responsible? Well, I think so, because he was given that responsibility. But where's everybody else to object here? I mean, and maybe there were some who were speaking up and saying some things, and Eliashib was kind of putting that off somehow. But, you know, it seems like there's more to the story, maybe. What? Yeah. What if he didn't come back? That's right. That's right. That's a good point. Brent and Earl.
The thing that I think that we need to remember here also is that this guy was a true enemy of not just God, but of Nehemiah.
Yeah.
He's the one that had tried to get that coalition together, tried to invite Nehemiah to go visit him. He tried to stop the repair of the walls. He tried to rebuild those. He was a
sure.
You did everything they could have prevented you from doing it, and you stood the ground, and then the very people that saw this and saw your strength over a period of time had allowed him to come and live in this room within the temple.
You know, to try to imagine the disappointment of Nehemiah is something that I don't know we can fully get a hold of here. But we can try to imagine that. You know, and you made a comment early as you were speaking about this, you know. Tobiah was an enemy of Nehemiah. Sometimes we will have enemies. It's not by our choice, by our choosing, but there will be those who want to work against us in some way, who are truly the enemy of God, and they'll do everything that they can to be our enemy. I mean, Paul had to face some that way. You know, that he even calls out in such way. He's writing to Timothy, he says, "Be diligent to come to me quickly. For Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, has departed to Thessalonica. Only Luke is with me." You know, Paul's feeling abandoned, you know, at this point. He goes on to say, "Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works." to whom you also be aware, for he has greatly resisted our words. You know, that's kind of, I mean, there's pretty strong language here. You know, as he says, Alexander, he did me a lot of harm. May the Lord repay him. You know, he's calling judgment, the Lord's judgment down upon him. You know, and sometimes we almost want to reject, you know, anything so harsh. I mean, Paul's kind of cutting to the chase here. You know, God's going to sort this out. And so, indeed, you know, Nehemiah had enemies, and Tobiah for sure was one of them that caused a lot of problems.
He allowed his grandson to marry Sanballat's daughter.
Yeah. So yeah, what a poor choice.
Playing all the power brokers in the area. Yeah. He was earning brownie points with all of them.
Yeah.
He forgot the main power broker.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, Nehemiah's response when he returned, you know, what did he do? What did Nehemiah do? Yeah, he's on this just straight away, you know. Yeah, I was greatly displeased. I threw out Tobiah's household goods out of the room. You know, I just get the impression, I don't see Nehemiah going and saying, well, let's box this up for Nehemiah and carry it over to his house. No, I just don't get this picture in my mind at all, you know. I mean, this stuff's just being heaved out, you know. Get this stuff out of here, you know. I mean, this is his response. I gave orders to purify the rooms. That just stuck with me. I like that. Now think for a moment. Think for a moment here something about, you know, this point. I gave orders to purify the rooms. What are some points or analogies that we've just got to draw from that?
Well, it reminds me of in the Old Testament, in the laws of leprosy, that they went in and had to clean the walls and everything to get every influence of that disease out of there.
Yeah.
And sometimes people want to halfway do something, but in our situation, we're supposed to keep ourselves clean.
James's plea for disciples: draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. I mean, there's just time and again where the emphasis is on purity for those of the people of God. Paul said to Titus, speaking of Christ, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. That we are the ones who are to be purified to stand before God. And those were just some things that kind of went through my mind there, is thinking about Nehemiah purifying those rooms. That's a really good point. Why didn't you think about that? Yeah, it wasn't just that he threw Tobiah out and cleaned the rooms. What did he put back in them? The things that were supposed to be there. Man, that's a powerful point. That slipped right by me. In fact, that's the point of the lesson right there. That had completely slipped by me. That is the point. Go ahead. Thinking back to the repentance of Israel here three chapters ago, which was brought about by the reading of the word. you know, we keep seeing that element.
I was just thinking that it's consistent with the idea of putting off and putting off.
Yes.
That we see in the New Testament, where you're putting off the old and, the old and putting on the new.
That's right. You can't put on the new until you take off the old, and you can't just take off the old without putting on the new. I mean, you have to go through that whole sequence. So many, I love this, so many incredible analogies that this helps us to see the power of the Word right here. Our time is gone. What I'd like us to do, Lord willing, on Wednesday night is take up in the bottom of page 23, point number 2. That's, remember, there are four points, or four issues, four major issues that we see Nehemiah has to deal with when he comes back to Jerusalem. And so we're looking at point number 2 on Wednesday night. Really good comments today. Appreciate so much your participation.